Well, maybe we should begin. This is going to be a discussion of teaching and doing, and something about the relation between writing fantasy and science fiction, or work of the Fantastica, and the teaching of it, and how the teaching of it affects the teacher's writing of it. This is the perception we have of what we're going to do. So I guess, first off, I'm going to ask each of the panelists to introduce him or herself and to say in what context they have taught, you know, what sorts of classes they've taught, either literature classes or creative writing classes in science fiction. So,
okay.
To my left.
Sure. My name is Gregory Wilson. I'm an associate professor of English at St. John's University, going into my 10th year there now, which is hard to believe. And I've taught courses in fantasy and science fiction and creative writing there, different courses, for pretty much all of that time. Also a writer. My first novel came out a couple of years ago. Next ones are being shopped. Short stories due out next month. And I've written several articles, including one related to the subject of this for the CIFWA Bulletin, which will be coming out towards the end of the year. And then my last hat that will connect to this is that I run with fellow speculative fiction author Brad Bollier a podcast called Speculate, the podcast for writers, readers, and fans, where we interview and talk about the work, writing techniques, and so forth of authors, editors, and even a couple of artists. That's more admiration, not so much technique, in the speculative fiction field, which you can find more about at speculatesf.com.
I run nothing. My name is Veronica Shanis. I'm assistant professor of English at Queen's College CUNY, where I teach a variety of things. And the spec fic generally comes in two places. I teach courses on contemporary revisions of fairy tales, and I teach a lot of children's literature with a specific focus on the golden age of children's literature, which is Alice in Wonderland to Winnie the Pooh, essentially. And on the development of the children's fantasy, starting with the water babies, God help the poor Victorian children, and coming up to whenever the present day is. I also write short stories, which seem to be publishable as they get published.
I'm John Kessel. I'm a professor of American literature and creative writing at North Carolina State University, where I have taught for many years courses in the history and development of fantasy and the history and development of science fiction literature classes. And then also I have taught many, many creative writing classes over the years in our undergraduate and MFA program. Some of them specifically aimed at the writing of what we might call Fantastica. Most of them not, although I have many students who write within the context of a regular workshop works of Fantastica.
My name is Jack Haringa. I'm chairman of the English department at Worcester Academy in Worcester, Massachusetts, and I teach elective courses on detective fiction, dystopian fiction, gothic literature, and I also managed to squeeze in some Angela Carter and J.G. Ballard to my AP literature course, and I have also taught creative writing, although not specifically targeted to speculative fiction.
I'm Michael Sisko.
Can you go louder, please?
Okay. I'm Michael Sisko. I'm a novelist, and I'm also a professor. I teach, I'm an associate professor, no, assistant, sorry. Give myself a assistant professor of English at CUNY Ostos in the South Bronx, and I teach English just to mainly to students who don't know English very well, but I have also I've also taught creative writing classes, and not specifically to genre, but just general, and I also developed a class of macabre and supernatural fiction for as an elective. That's me.
So one of the distinctions here is that the teaching of creative writing versus the teaching of literature, and some of us have taught both. Veronica, you just taught the literature.
I've just taught the literature.
And you taught creative writing?
I have taught some creative writing.
Okay.
Mainly.
So the first question I guess I want to start with is, does teaching science fiction, fantasy, or Fantastica improve your writing of it? Or does it not? Maybe why or why not?
For me, it absolutely does. I think everyone on the panel will tell you that one of the best ways to learn more about a field is to teach it, and most teachers will tell you something of the same. And for me, one of the things that I find most valuable about teaching it is my courses. I finally got this year, was able to split for the first time this past year that just ended, science fiction and fantasy into two courses, which is nice because I have more time now to give introductions to each. And what I find is that the vast majority of my students are on the introductory level when it comes to genre. You know, they vaguely know about it. They kind of like Batman, you know, so they have this vague sense that things that are outside the sort of norm of literary fiction is something that they're interested in. But I don't get a lot of, you know, hardcore Doctor Who aficionados, if you see what I mean. So most of what I'm doing is trying to take the kernel of interest that's usually there and building it into something more. And as a consequence, a lot of what I work with in my class is giving them bridges from where they are to where I am, hopefully. And in the process of doing that, in the process of seeing these works through the perspective of students that haven't encountered a lot of them in this context, at least not with a certain kind of academic rigor, is incredibly valuable to me in my own writing and allows me to pick up on things in those books that I might not have seen were I not breaking them down in my own mind and getting ready to teach them. So there's no question that for me it's been of enormous value in that respect. There is a danger that in the process of doing this you can kind of, I'm not entirely sure how to put it, sort of reduce it into your in your own mind to the reaction of your students more than just sort of the reaction of everyone, including your students. So there is a little bit of myopia you have to be careful of when you dive into really working with them. But for the most part, it's enormously valuable to me as a writer when I go to work on various aspects of fiction and can think about the reactions that people who were not part of the genre and didn't know a lot about it before, their reactions to the works I taught inform the way that I write similar works. So, yes, for me.
Can I, if I might follow up?
Yeah.
Can you think of a specific example of something that you sort of realized or understood from teaching that has specifically helped you in your writing?
Yes. I'll take it on the literature side. One of the things that when I first began writing genre that I was most concerned with was showing off how interesting the worlds were that I had created, interesting being in quotes and in my own mind. This is a really neat thing that I want to present, and these are so fascinating, and they're going to really get into this. And what I found in teaching some books that have worked and some books that haven't is that students oftentimes react much less well, at least at the beginning, to the incredibly different worlds as they do to the characters who animate and live in those worlds. And so one of the things that was helpful for me is being aware that I needed to move people through these worlds as much or as more as if I had not been doing genre at all. In other words, I needed to get away from kind of the source book problem, you know, where you produce this beautiful world that seems incredibly well realized and developed and with, you know, monsters to spare and with magic systems and economic systems and everything else, and bored the hell out of anyone, you know, who didn't want to get 10 pages into it, and they're like, yeah, I didn't really want to read a textbook. I needed to not write textbooks, I needed to write novels. And so teaching books like that, and I'll give two examples, one that worked and one that didn't. I've tried on a couple of occasions to teach Neuromancer. And I'm still working on it, and I haven't given up on it, but it has not worked particularly well. And part of the reason, I think, is that my students find the world that's being presented astonishingly dense. My thought was, you know, they're going to think of it as it's an introduction to the Matrix. It gives them this, these are things they'll be used to. And for them, there are so many different layers going on there that it's sort of difficult to unwind them, which doesn't mean, as I say, I've given up on it, but I'm going to need to take another couple cracks on it going in a different direction. Whereas a book like, let's say, to use the science fiction example again, Ender's Game, works extremely well with my students because of how well they identify with Ender, because of how well they identify with the characters in that book that are animating that story. Doesn't mean that I want to write every book like Ender's Game and never write anything like Neuromancer, but the point is that's something I need to think about as well if I want to make work that's not only interesting in my head, but interesting to people reading it. So that's what it's like.
I think so, but in a far less direct way than Gregory finds it works for him. What I find interesting is sort of tracing the development of a genre, say children's fantasy, British children's fantasy, for the sake of argument, is usually focused on British because, I don't want to go into that. And understanding that development gives me, when you teach something, even more than when you research it, right, you have to understand how it works. Because you have to be able to explain to somebody who is not already practiced in literary analysis how it works. And so it for me, it helps me see more clearly the different kinds of moves and techniques that an author will make or use in a given piece. So it gives me both, I think, a good understanding of how certain moves and techniques developed, and also an awareness of when I'm employing them in my own work, so that, well, a lot of that happens unconsciously, right? You absorb the knowledge unconsciously, you use it unconsciously, but when I'm going back after that first draft and thinking, do I really want to do that there, right? Do I really want this to be, you know, that I've set it up like an intrusion fantasy. Do I want it to be an intrusion fantasy? Am I E. Nesbitt? So I think it does help in the way that greater understanding of anything helps you understand how to work with it, right? My understanding is musicians don't just study how to play their instruments, but they study how their instruments work. Once they reach a certain level, obviously not. Or, you know, and they know, and I feel like I need to know how the tools I'm using to put together a story work. And so that would be my answer.
Michael, I'm going to flip over to you. Me, you know. So, thing is, I started writing when I was young. I wrote my first novel when I was 21. And by the time I actually got around to having a teaching job, I kind of solidified my style and what I was doing. So I'm tempted just to say no and hand it back, but I don't think that's true entirely. teaching creative writing classes, my goal was to have the students teach it as much as possible. As I got to the, I can't present myself as an expert. There's writers, but I don't know if there's expert writers. I have experience. Whether or not I'm an expert would, you know, so that's sort of up for the class to decide. If it plays out well, then I guess I'm an expert. If not, then I'm an ass. And you know, that's not for me to say. It's not for me to sit there and preside. So, but what helped sort of underscore for me, I guess, in composing work was not to foreclose possibilities. So I would be talking with students and I'd be encouraging them to read their stuff to each other and so on. And say, well, why don't you do it like this? Or why don't we turn it that way? Why would it be different than this? What if the street were the character instead of the people on the street? What would it see? And you just sort of say, okay, and then it's like being in training. It's like someone throws something at you and you compose it. And so they can keep you kind of deft when it comes to your own writing so that you don't trap yourself in possibilities. You don't say, okay, it's going to be like this. I sort of like what you were saying, like, it was a wonderful phrase. What fantasy?
Intrusion fantasy.
Right, so it's like an intrusion fantasy. It's not just, am I doing this, but am I locking myself into some sort of fixed pattern that I don't want to be locked into? Am I too rigid here? Do I need to be more flowing there? And of course, I started writing more. My stuff is all kind of very refractedly autobiographical in some ways. Not at all, not that the corpse eating is not funny. I do eat meat, so I'm kind of technically. I don't eat living, so yeah, of course. But anyway, stuff about incompetent teachers and shambolic schools starts percolating into my work. Just sort of, also, the relationship between teacher and student, I think, is extremely interesting. What's my responsibility? Why is the student there? Am I an authority? Am I an author? What does that mean? And so on. And just figuring it out again. And it's the students who keep showing you you're wrong. You're wrong about who you think you are, what relationship you think you have to them. And so you can't just decide what that is. You have to kind of be open and stay flexible. So that is certainly, it's affected me in subtle ways. I think that they'll happen back here and then work their way out in my life in all kinds of ways, which includes how I write.
Jack? My answer is very different.
Okay.
Because I think the effect on my writing has certainly been much less complete. I think that really the teaching of any kind of literature can improve your writing. I mean, if you're teaching good writing, you're particularly on a sentence level aware of how things work and having to explain it and having things questioned.
Yep.
I'm very lucky in teaching in a private school and being chair of the department that I get to pretty much pick everything I teach. I don't have any rules, which is, you know, at the secondary level, not generally the case. So that I get to put Ballard in my classes and things like that. But in the process of teaching it and having smart students ask you questions that you are sort of obligated to answer, you know, I don't know, go look it up yourself, is not sufficient. You know, they want, even if your answer is, let's interrogate this together, that in the process of that, you know, I think there are just endless revelations to how fiction works that then you can take as, well, that's a technique. I can use that. Because, you know, all fiction is about, I don't know, 60, 70, 90% theft. It's, you know, you're just stealing.
Borrowing, right, please,
folks,
borrowing.
Right? No. Techniques, tropes, and ideas. And
steal?
Taking a trope that somebody has used really well and saying,
they can steal it as borrowing.
Now, thanks Angela Carter for showing me that I can take a trope I like and turn it on its head and see what happens, to those characters and that sort of thing. And then because the speculative fiction that I teach is very much sort of the stuff that touches my heart and it's the stuff that I want to kind of write, interrogating that at the same level, you know, I'm tackling, I'm trying to think of a good example. You know, I'm maybe tackling an Arthur Machen story like The White People, mm-hmm. the same way that I'm tackling Conrad's Heart of Darkness. Like, mm-hmm. I mean, I'm investigating it at the sentence level, at the metaphor level, at the cultural level, in the same way. And then I sit down to write, and I think, how do I make metaphors work effectively that way without being bald-faced metaphors, but being more subtle. Mm-hmm. It is learning at the feet of the masters, even while you're sort of trying to teach the masters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have learned an awful lot from teaching both science fiction as literature and how to write science fiction or fantasy. For the literature part is interesting, and you know, there are real pluses because what Veronica says is true. I think if you have to explain how something works, then you have to understand that, and that really can help you to apply those things in your own work. So, you know, on a kind of basic level, you know, teaching The Man in the High Castle, you know, I'd read it more than once before, but I hadn't really understood, for instance, that every chapter is two characters' points of view. It's two halves to every chapter, or equal size, and alternating chapters. No two points of view are the same consecutively in the entire book. Every chapter has two points of view in it. I hadn't really thought about that. I never analyzed that until I had to teach it. And then I thought, well, what is the effect of that? Why did he do it that way? You know, maybe he did it consciously for a reason, or maybe he fell into it. But, you know, that really was very interesting to me. Okay? And actually, when I wrote my novel, Good News from Outer Space, I consciously started out already writing the first half of it anyway, doing exactly that, with two characters, author point of view, for every chapter. And then I actually got halfway through, and I realized, and that was a straitjacket for me, and I ended up breaking all those into separate chapters. But you know, that you know, having to teach it and sort of understand it caused me to think about the structure of the book in a way that I probably wouldn't have otherwise. And so that kind of revelation can come up, I think, fairly often. And on the other hand, I mean, what you say about stealing? I mean, yeah, okay, stealing is you know, it's the, to me, I mean, I guess I'm sort of notorious for my theft. I mean, I literally will write response stories to, you know, to Frankenstein, okay? So to me, that's, you know, that's, I'm so inspired by literature, almost to the point where it's actually, I think, in my case, almost a danger, okay, that I'm always reading something and thinking, oh, wow, you know, this is interesting how Mary Shelley did this, or, you know, Melville did this, and I'm going to respond to that, what he did, and you know, maybe I should, you know, In other words, there's a downside to this too. And that's something I guess I did want to mention. I do think that if you've taught something a lot and you've gotten deeply into it and you feel like you understand it, it can feel like you really sort of have dried it out, okay? And it doesn't have much surprise for you anymore. And not only that, you sort of feel that there, you end up learning certain, feeling that there's only that way to do it, okay? Or there's a certain limited number of ways to do it. You know, I worry sometimes about becoming derivative. I'd be too steeped in the history of science fiction so that every time travel story I write would be a response to some other person's time travel story. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but on the other hand, if you didn't know the history of time travel stories, you might just repeat and reinvent the wheel. So I don't know how you feel about that.
I mean, in my creative writing course, I'll run into some of that where I'll always have one or two of the students who will sort of give me the, you know, I don't want to go into depth in learning about this particular thing because then I'm going to end up taking their voice as my own. And, you know, they're obviously doing it on a level where they have not had exposure to that many voices, which is a little bit different from what you're saying. But in each case, yeah, I mean, the answer is that's a risk you're going to have to take, it seems to me, if you are to make sure that you can, having understood the rules, then be capable of breaking them. So I always use the Joyce Ulysses example, which is that, you know, people, you'll teach Ulysses and you'll read Ulysses and you'll think this breaks every rule in the book to that time, right? Every chapter is a different concept, is a different structure, is a different, and so forth. And the reason, of course, that Joyce is able to do it is because he knows every single rule absolutely perfectly first, which is why he writes things like Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man before he writes something like Ulysses, and then he writes Ulysses before he writes Finnegan's Wake, right? The point is that in each of these cases, he knows the rules first. So I think what you said towards the end is what I would say, which is that I think that's a risk they're going to have to take. You have to understand these, and you'll worry later about how derivative it comes. Since we said theft, and everyone said, oh, okay, that sounds fine, I guess we're okay. You know, I guess that people are all right with that. Then,
what I'm talking about a theft is that, unless it's in the most picayune manner of theft, that you can't, you know, really, you can't be Mary Shelley. You can't be, you know, you're not going to be James Joyce, so you're going to be yourself regardless.
Right.
So, you know, whatever you learn from Joyce will probably end up being transmuted in your own work into something new.
And don't think they didn't steal either.
Yeah,
sure. I actually used the word, you know, theft, and it's a complete reference to, you know, to Eliot's line in the tradition of the individual talent, you know, that the young poets borrow and mature poets steal, mm-hmm. right? And the difference is that, you know, with the young poet, it's clearly derivative. They haven't made it their own. When you steal something, you make it your own. It's now yours. Mm. It's in your possession.
It depends on whether you have something to say. That's the point. Right. You take someone else's tropes or their own voice or something, and then, you know, if you're just trying to reproduce their effects or ape them, you're going to do that to a certain extent. That's part of the curve. And then you see, you write things that fail, and they just fail. So you fail. And then you, if you have something to say, it will organize itself around, you will organize your patterning around that, and it won't, the theft as it is, it's not an impediment. It's not a problem. I mean, my concern is that, because this is another aspect of the academic side of things, is that in reading theory, and when you read stuff that's extremely abstract about fiction, I tend to worry that, is this going to, you know, I don't want to end up writing things that just are sort of illustrations of different theoretical positions. Like, this is just really just an adjunct to a theoretical construct that is just kind of hanging out there in limbo and has no kind of oomph. It doesn't have any viscera. It just becomes a kind of curiosity instead of some living piece.
My next question was, you know, is there any way in which the academic study of this stuff can hinder you or be a problem?
I actually want to intervene thinking about the theft.
Okay.
If we can just go back to the theft metaphor for a moment, because one of the things it does, right, is it sort of supposes a sort of very Harold Bloomian agonistic relationship with
Edible.
Yes, Oedipal, God, yes. Agonistic relationship with the writer from whom you're stealing. And that's certainly one model, but it's heavily invested in Freud, in Freudian theory that is really a touch discredited at this point. It's heavily invested in an extraordinarily patriarchal view of writing, right? It's all about discovering the muse as a harlot who's been unfaithful to you because she's slept with your father, who now she's a whore, even though she's your mother. You know, it
says a lot more about Bloom than it does.
Exactly.
It's like big hairy guys crashing into each other's stories.
And one of my projects, actually, one of the parts of my first book, which is coming out, God willing, next year, is about thinking about other ways we can think of that model. Can we think of it also as collaboration? So I wanted to interject in there on the
ceiling. Sure. There's participation. There's, you know, if I see somebody who's like who's doing something that I've done, I don't feel robbed or in any way depleted. How have you taken anything from me? You know, like if I, part of the purpose of art is to make you want to do art. You see something, you say, I gotta do that somehow, or I need to. I'm in there already, in a sense.
It's adding to the common creative fount in a way that we're all drawing from.
And I'm already there. It's like I'm already in it. You know, yeah, it's not like I'm somehow an outsider who's swiping stuff from it. I'm already implicated in this because it connects to me in an intimate way already.
Do you ever worry...
Jack was talking.
The tradition of the individual talent, actually, does not follow that.
Yeah, I remember.
Right? He's basically saying that sort of
the poets make room
for it. And I mean, my master's thesis was a theory on on influence between writers of popular fiction, and I really kind of looked at Lovecraft as this model. It's much more of a sort of grandfatherly or avuncular, and it's still patriarchal, but not linear. And it's more about my grandfather, you know, gave me this or told me this story that I could share, kind of thing. And it's much more benign.
And then I invented something that he used in his story.
Right.
Yes. And it cross-pollinates on the same plane instead of opposite. So there's some of that, but it's not strictly
that. Yeah.
It's not adversary.
You are always existing at the same time as other poets, right? You are always holding them in your head, and your work makes their work slightly different because it's seen in a slightly different light.
Which, by the way, to jump back to the teaching for a second, is one of the reasons why it's important, and there's always a danger, whatever works you choose to represent in your classes, that those become the works that students will assume, this is science fiction is Dr. Wilson's class. And, you know, so one of the things I'm at pains to do in both of my classes is to try to suggest that I'm opening a door into a room in which there is a conversation with numerous voices of which we will only be able to focus on a few at a time, right? And, you know, what they need to do then after I've done that is to continue on into the room while I go off and do something else, and they get a chance to listen to all of these voices, so it doesn't feel as linear as you were talking about, and this begat that, which is really dangerous.
That's one of my first lectures. One of the things I say is when you take my class or any of my classes, my science fiction class, what you're getting is my reading of this.
Right.
And not only that, my reading of that this semester. And it's going to be, it was different in the past, it's going to be different in the future. And if you have a different teacher teaching exactly the same course with the same, course description, you get an entirely different course.
Well, it sounds like you're both very comfortable in trying to evacuate your own authority in the classroom. And that was certainly one of the teaching techniques I was taught. But it strikes me that it's not equally useful for all people. One of the things I have to do in the classroom is work to establish my authority, right? As I have had students tell me that their D-minus paper, I just didn't understand it, but next time they'd dumb it down for me. And my associate chair noted that he'd never had that, but students say that all the time to young female professors, right? Mm. So I'm very careful, actually, about not evacuating my own authority in the classroom, both because there's only so much of that I can put up with, but also because I want to model authority and expertise for the young women in my class.
Can I ask you a question?
Mm-hmm.
Would your writing of it, of your sort of representation that you also write short stories and things like that, would that restore that authority for them? And I ask only because in my class, when they find out that I'm a writer, it changes very much for them the equation, where they think, I was lucky enough to have Brandon Sanderson actually did an hour-long Skype video chat with my class because I taught his book, The Alloy of Law, in the spring. That was great, by the way, and it was his idea. It was like, I met him, and he said, would you like to do this? And I said, yes, please. And the students, who I had prepared, you know, for this, you will have 5 questions, and you will ask each of them, because I didn't want there to be any moments of awkward silence. But they absolutely loved it, and they felt the fact that I could bring him, and that I knew him because I was a writer at WorldCon, sitting on a panel near him, and then spoke to him afterwards, that for me, you know, gave that authority. So I don't know. Yeah. I'm just wondering.
That it's usually not something that occurs to me, but the other thing is students Google their professors almost immediately.
Yeah.
And if you Google me, academics leave a trail a mile wide. Science fiction writers leave a trail a mile wide, so it's very easy.
Yeah.
So I do get students coming up and saying, you know, I read your story, and I just so amazed. And it's always a very nice moment for me, you know? And I have guested in other in my colleague's class, in a colleague's class, when she taught one of my stories. And I get that was 2 years ago, and I still get students coming up to me on campus saying they were in that class. Yeah. So actually, that never occurred to me, but I think I will try it.
I would have to say, I wanted to modify a little bit. The fact that I would say that, you know, what you get from me this semester is different from the last semester, and what also what you get from a different teacher would be completely different, does not, I think, abdicate authority, okay? Because I'm not saying that every opinion is exactly equal. I'm saying that you know, there are many, you know, informed opinions. There are, you know, in any area, any discipline, there are going to be, you know, different visions.
There's a question of skill. I've been doing this longer.
Yes.
You can put anything in front of me. I don't necessarily need to read secondary literature. I can read it and take it apart and tell you how it works because I can do it. It's a skill. And I can impart that skill to you in some measure. But on the other hand, the class isn't about making me happy personally. This isn't, you know, I'm not a martinet. This isn't I just agonize over. You know, it's like, how do you establish this isn't about pleasing me. It's about achieving a certain level of accomplishment. Mm-hmm. And that's tricky.
And there's a certain desire, I think, in students, certainly at the secondary level, they want the answer. Yeah. What is the meaning of this poem or this novel? Mm-hmm. One correct meaning that
because
I can
I'm
write,
have to
say about
write it back to you on the test.
Right, right. Right.
And I would like the secret decoder, right?
Tell me what the answer is so I can copy it down and then I'll repeat it.
Yeah, their eyes light up when the author's in front of them. They'll tell me now the answer.
And I love that when I have guest authors and they won't tell them.
Yeah.
Actually, they specifically refuse.
Actually, a mind-blowing thing I did for them that I taught James Patrick Kelly's story, Think Like a Dinosaur, and I had a question on my midterm exam. Was about that, and so it was a little short essay, and they had to write the essay, and I took the exams with me to grade at the ICFA conference down in Florida, and Jim Kelly was my roommate there. So I was sitting there grading the exams in the room, so, you know, I'm grading exams, so, you know, I got a question on one of your story, things like that. So I said, well, can I grade it? And so he did. He graded that question on the test, okay? And then when I came back, I said, well, you know, I didn't grade this one. The author graded this question.
Oh, I thought you were going to give it to them and have them say, I don't know if I agree with this interpretation. I don't know. What does this guy know?
Well, one thing to counter that sort of desire for one answer that I do is, you know, when I teach Beowulf, I sort of introduce them to theory. Mm-hmm. And I give them the new historicist read, and here's how a new historicist would interpret it, and here's how a cultural critic would interpret it, and then here's the Freudian reading of it. And, you know, I go through it, and I said, you know, none of these are wrong. Mm-hmm. Well, maybe Freud.
But I was going to say.
No, none of them are, the psychoanalytically, I should say, none of them are wrong, but they're all informed perspectives on the same piece. So stop asking them for the right answer.
Right.
Just interpret.
If we're teaching something, that you know, what I'll say is, you know, instead of trying to establish a theme or main idea for the text and then teach to that idea, what I'm trying to say is, you tell me what the main idea of this is. Mm-hmm. We workshop that idea. Not that everybody needs to agree, but in that sense of trying to get everyone into this kind of false consensus, but to get them to, it's like, you tell me. I mean, it's very difficult, and I don't do this very well, but that's what I'm trying to make it work, and I'm trying to. But I want to get them to teach the class. I want to get them to lead the class if I can. You tell me what this is about. And, you know, you can debate about what it's about. Or you can debate the meaning of this. And so to try to bring, so, you know, why should I come in and just give them one idea? You know, and then they can say, well, what do you think it's about? And I give them my opinion, but I say, that's my opinion.
And in defense of the students, you know, a lot of them come to us in the first place preconditioned to assume, either because of subject that they've studied before or because of, frankly, the process that they've learned under before, that they are looking for, that's kind of a vast Where's Waldo game, right, where you're looking for the thing, and if you don't discover it, then you failed, you know. And so you can kind of understand why they're this anxious, right? I mean, they're looking for the answer because they've been told you must find the answer. And so one of the things that I think we do need to sort of give them an idea is that there are ranges, as you said before, John, there are ranges of opinions and ideas and concepts that will demonstrate a better sense of advanced understanding of these fields and genres, and that will allow you to apply them to other genres, by the way. The same kind of processes you use to break these down in my class, you can use to break these things down in other classes, and that process won't have to alter. So that they don't feel that everything else they get, it's like this, and they come into our class, and it's, well, it's all very, you know, I don't want them to feel that at sea. You know, so I just want to, in their defense a little bit, we are sort of working with many years, sadly, of the way they've been conditioned to this point. So,
shift gears slightly, it was one of the other things mentioned in the description of this panel, and that was, I'll put it this way, if you're a SF writer and academic teacher, what is your responsibility to the genre? By that I mean, if you're teaching a class on fantasy or science fiction, are you obligated to teach the classics as they are understood within the genre, but maybe it may not be known outside, by people who don't know the history and development of the genre, or is your obligation to teach works that have that will connect with them in a way that they might be familiar with? Okay, in other words, are you there proselytizing, or are you a scholar? Okay,
I would teach it exactly like I teach anything else.
Yeah.
I would try not to I would just treat it. It's all literature. That would be my problem.
But suppose you had a choice between doing something that would be more familiar to them versus teaching a classic, Frankenstein, okay?
It's very tricky. It can be certain things. It depends on the class and circumstances. I think it really depends on your students. My students, I taught them Hill House, and they didn't understand Old Maid. They didn't understand why Eleanor is so frantic. They said, she's not that old. I said, but, 1960, yeah, she was old. But then I taught them different class, but same school. We've always lived in the castle. And they were totally pattern locked on Mary Cat. They knew exactly what she was all about.
Mm-hmm.
They knew, one of them called her Machine Gun Mary Cat because she just gunned down the whole family dead. I don't know. It's a judgment call, but in general, I'm doing science fiction in the fall, and it's the first time I'm teaching it, and I had to. My feeling was I could give them things that are trickier to understand, and then I can send them out to look at things that are more maybe contemporary or things that are, if they want to read Twilight, I won't stop them. I won't enjoy it, but I won't stop them. But it would be like, I might teach them something. I would say, okay, you want to do Twilight? Let me show you some of the backstory there. Let me show you some antecedents to that. So let's look at Joanna Russ's story, like Manny Randall. And let's look at those two and then talk about what their relationship.
I think it strongly depends on the kind of class you want to teach, right? Mm-hmm. I always make that very clear that it's a conscious and constructed choice on the first day of the class when we go through the syllabus, right? Mm-hmm. In one class, I'll say, I've chosen to structure this class by genre. It's a survey class, right? So first we will look at poetry, and then we will look at the novel, but if I'm doing my British children's fantasy class, I say, we're going through this chronologically, right? And here's why, and here's what I've had to leave out, and here's what I've included. So I find that it depends. Do you want a historical overview? If so, I try to include the greatest hits, right? I can't teach British children's fantasy and not teach Peter Pan and Alice in Wonderland. That would be absolutely idiotic. But it would also be completely irresponsible of me not to teach Mary Louise Molesworth and Juliana Horatia Ewing and all the other sort of golden age women writers who sort of dropped out of canon. Because that's right, they were incredibly popular at the time. And if you want a sense of what's going on in the golden age, you have to teach them. In terms of proselytizing, though, I just don't feel I get paid enough. Honestly, right? I don't feel I get paid enough to have an obligation to teach anything except exactly what I want to teach and what I feel my department needs and what I feel responsible to being a good scholar. Being a good scholar teacher, giving a responsible overview means.
I think there's a bit of a false dichotomy in the question, in part because in the scope of the course, you kind of can do both.
Yeah.
That is that you can teach sort of the things that you maybe personally love, short stories or what have you, but also give them some of those canonical bridge works. I know, when I taught the first time I taught the dystopian course, I started with Semyatin's We, which is a bit of a slog, but it lays all these sort of tropes out as things that then other writers reference. But at the other end, I also did Jack Womack's Random Acts of Senseless Violence, which is criminally out of print, by the way, and students loved it, and it was sort of, this is my gateway to getting you to read then the wackier Jack Womack stuff, and then the William Gibson, and let's get you into cyberpunk and all of that. And not so much proselytizing as saying, there is a range, here's stuff I really like, but it's also stuff that I think warrants critical attention. And mm-hmm. and that's, so I guess that there's an obligation of the scholar and the fan, where do those Venn diagrams overlap, is kind of how I choose my work. That, you know, I will choose T.J. Wagner's story, like Styx, because I think it's incredibly effective, and understanding why it's effective means that I can examine the use of metaphor and the construction of narrative. But that's certainly in no way a canonical story.
Yeah, and I always tell them, every syllabus is provisional, right? I'm going to teach this course again, and I will swap out texts and put in new texts, right? Because A, new stuff comes out all the time. When I teach my fairy tale course, you know, I'm going to teach Ash by Melinda Lowe next year, and that wasn't out when I started teaching this course, so I wasn't teaching it. That the syllabus could have gone a number of ways.
Does the fact that you are a writer yourself alter your choices in teaching and how you teach and what you teach in these classes?
What would I teach if I weren't a writer? I don't know.
Yeah, I'd have to not be a writer then.
Yeah. Exactly. I don't know that I could separate it.
I think
necessarily
being a writer shapes your tastes.
Yeah, but I mean, do you think your approach to how to teach a book might be a little different? Here's one thing that comes up to me sometimes, and that I'm aware of, the sort of the commercial process that a writer goes through to get a book published, which a scholar almost never talks about. Okay. And there are certain practical considerations about how a book is made and published, and where it was published, and how it was published, and what the whole system was at that time, that you know, most literary scholars don't ever even think about. Okay.
Well, I disagree with that. No, from the scholars I know, especially the ones in the early modern period, the Renaissance, they're very aware of how Shakespeare's plays are performed, how they would have been received. Nobody does the full Hamlet.
I'm not thinking Shakespeare. I'm thinking, you know, Robert Heinlein. Okay, and sorry about that. I don't know. It seems to me that's a place where we might be able to bring something to the teaching that someone who's just simply a PhD in lit theory might not be able to do.
That's something, I'll go back to the Sanderson example, that's something that came up in that talk, where the students were interested not just in some, you know, questions about book as literature, you know, I was interested about this, how did you produce this system, how did these characters develop in your mind, these sorts of things, and then sort of, were you thinking about this in this theoretical way or this theoretical way, but also, you know, how did you get this published? You know, my students were asking questions like that. I mean, how did you, and Brandon, to his credit, also because he has a teaching background, was able to move, I think, relatively smoothly, you know, among those questions and answers. But I think the fact that we were dealing with both, you know, we were in the academic context, but we're talking about it from the perspective of writing. In that sense, that's true. I hadn't thought about it, but that's true. I mean, that did sort of change around the way that my students would have received it. And, you know, with some sense of relief, because it felt more real to them. You know, I mean, frankly, not to be kind of morbid about it, but just confronting a living author was nice, you know.
It humanized the process.
Yes, I mean, exactly. And the fact that he thought it was important enough to be able to speak to them and do so in a way that he thought he enjoyed their questions. He said at the end, you know, I found these are really great questions, and you all did a really great job. And you could see them. He said that we did a really great, you know. And so that was nice. And yes, I think you're right about that.
I think maybe, I don't know if this is pretty, painting with a broad brush, I guess I would say, that I think people who write and also teach literature oftentimes will call attention to an aesthetic appeal of, isn't this just cool the way he did this?
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to go any deeper on that. I just want you to notice this. This is cool.
Mm-hmm.
Look at how he made you think about this. Or look at the way that, you know, she manipulated you to expect this, and this happened. And that's it. You know, we're going to move on now. That's not the focus of this, but let's have that aesthetic appreciation of it that I think, you know, sometimes a pure, dry scholar doesn't always take that cap.
I guess I take issue a little bit with the question, because I know a lot of people who are not writing fiction or poetry or anything like that, who are very passionate about writing and do aesthetically appreciate it. So I think it's very hit and miss.
Mm-hmm.
And I think scholarship is creative.
Yes.
I think it is creative work. They are right. The scholars write. Mm-hmm. And they are all writers. I mean, they're not writing fiction. But, so I think we got to be careful about this sort of thing. I mean, there are people who will say, I do creative work, and this is my analysis. I created it. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm a little leery of that. I mean, we're all writers. It has to do with sort of like, I think it's more like what you were saying, that we're sort of in the biz of that dimension of the business and so forth. And so it may be that our attention is turned in a certain way, and we're sensitive to things like new developments and so on. But I don't know that it's that distinct a difference. I know a lot of people.
I strongly agree with that. I mean, and literary criticism is as amenable to the elegant and beautiful sentence as any other.
On show.
Yeah, as any other literature is. And my favorite scholars are often the ones who write beautifully.
Yeah. In fact, it's kind of cool to actually hold up those texts for literary appreciation.
Yes.
And say, let's just look at how this is. Look at what he's doing here. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know. I think that's a skill that no one owns that. It's just sort of like the scholars don't own this, and the writers own that. I think we all do it in sort of maybe very different levels.
Let's open this to some questions here.
Right, just real quick. Speculative fiction writers have an insight that's very valuable. And if you came to the period of modernism, expatriates, you could do Indian Camp by Hemingway, you could do Rosemary by Faulkner, and Babylon Revisited by Fitzgerald. But you'd actually give a better picture of modernism if you did the first two stories, and instead of Babylon Revisited, you did Diamond as Big as the Ritz, or perhaps Benjamin Button. Because what you'd be showing is the imaginative spectrum of modernism, which too often becomes flattened out. I'm not sure I'd make the same decision between Charlotte Perkins Gilman's Her Land and Yellow Wallpaper. If I had to choose one or the other, I might want my students to have the Yellow Wallpaper experience. But it's a very interesting thing. There are times we should be applying our knowledge and our specific knowledge to actually make better portraits of the very periods we're trying to show.
Yeah,
I agree.
John, one of the things I think you kind of get a little sidetracked from when you were talking about just bringing your writerly experience to how works come into existence, into being. When I teach my science fiction course, that's something that I focus on with, you know, the history of the story, how it made it through so much that I know of it. And that's something that my students are really riveted by. And it makes it more real for them. Yep. It makes it more tangible. They see it not as something ephemeral or something that they could never reach, but this is work. And there's a whole kind of interesting history here. Part of it's gossipy, but part of it's also just fascinating.
Part of it, and it's you know, tangentially related, is the commercial forces that sometimes affected the way that those books were produced or that representations of those books were produced. So, you know, I teach iRobot in my science fiction class, and I joke a lot that a lot of the books I teach end up being terrible movies. And the execrable iRobot movie, which is actually the opposite of what Asimov is suggesting in the book, I'm able to talk a little bit about that and about, did you know that there's an actual script written by one of Asimov's best friends and also a superlative writer himself, Harlan Ellison, that's been languishing? And I've gotten emails, which I always find very, I say to my wife, okay, I got another one, because I'll get an email. You were right. I saw the movie. It has nothing to do with the book. And I said, yes. Well done. Well done. So you're right. That sort of expressing the commercial effects and the way one thing goes to the other is something they are very interested in. That's correct.
Something so simple as the fact.
John W. Campbell.
Sure.
Yeah. Yep. Right. The editorial process, the fact that most of this stuff was written to be paid by the word.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, so is Dickens. I mean, everybody writes.
Well, I think that someone teaching Dickens should also say that.
They do,
okay.
Though. I mean, that's...
Right, but I don't think people say, you know...
Just commodities.
I don't think that, you know, the commodity side of literature gets spoken of enough in the classroom.
Okay. I mean, I think it does. The Victorianists I know talk about the serial and what it means to write for a serial and how that affects the plotting.
I kind of agree with John, though. I don't. It's not what I've encountered. I try to bring up in my classes, but my sense is that there is a distinction with a lot of my colleagues between those things. I kind of agree with John. Absolutely. That my experience has been that way. I don't think it gets taught enough.
The more recent generations of scholars are more aware of those things than the earlier ones. I don't know.
My colleagues look at me cross-eyed when I bring that stuff up.
You had a question.
Yes, I did. Yes, I want to second what Michael said about drawing out interpretations and responses to literature from your students. In the last century, I taught high school English in New York City. And one experience I want to share that has to do with exactly that has to do when we I was teaching The Telltale Heart. And one female student asked questions such as, why did she have to kill the old man?
That's her.
Yes. And I said, well, what do you think? And she said, I guess it's because she didn't like the old man's eye. And then she said, but why did she have to cut up the old man? And I said, wait a minute. Why do you keep saying she?
Why not?
Yeah, exactly. There's no gender in here.
And she said something to that effect. Why not? Couldn't the narrator have been a she? Was it ever indicated whether it was a male or female? And we all looked back, and the whole class looked back. No, not at all. And so we all benefited. We all, you know, it was an interesting inspiration.
I had a moment just like that. And someone said, what if Bartleby is illiterate? What if he literally just copies what he sees, but he can't actually read and write? And this was a possibility I'd never seen discussed in secondary literature. No one had ever talked about it. It just wouldn't occur to most scholars that maybe Bartleby's illiterate. That's what you're looking for. That's a pearl that you save.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, yes, you found something new. That's what we're here to do. Not just repeat what I know and rehearse it for you. We're trying to make progress here.
That question goes straight into the marginalia in my
exactly.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Interesting.
Next time I'm teaching it.
I've cited students and things.
Yeah, I've tried their names. You know, it's like, if you said it, I'll cite you.
Yeah.
I will.
Well, yeah, I was teaching, I teach the Ballets of Marie de France, and we're reading Bisque Vrai, which is the werewolf story. And the first year I was teaching, and I had this group of students who came up with this idea that maybe he's gay. You know, maybe this is his secret way of getting out of his marriage in order to indulge in, you know, his secret sin of homosexuality. And that's a really valid reading of that. That actually works here entirely. Wow, you know, right into my book. That will be my next published essay.
I've occasionally taken an issue that I'm working on and something I'm writing, a piece of fiction, into my creative writing class and presented it as a problem for my students to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And I've gotten good stuff from there. Yeah. Yes. Brett.
Sorry. To what you were talking earlier about teaching material and aspects of the thing, I mean, I think my experience has been that the people who work with Shakespeare and Dickens are very likely to consider the material and even commercial aspects of things. When the people who are dealing with modernism, at least from when John and I were in graduate school, I think significantly less likely to do that. But I think that may be changing.
And maybe that is changing. Because a long time to
and all that. I had to mention that many years ago when I was a graduate instructor just down the road from John, I had to come in and talk to a science fiction class I was teaching, and for the rest of the time, if people would say, well, John Kessel said this, John Kessel said that, and it was just his authority as a writer of science fiction had a significant impact on there, and of course you'll be happy to know, John, that I also had Orson Scott Card same class, and some of them did say, well, Orson Scott Card says this, that, and the other.
They're both in the class at the same time. That would
battle it out, if it were. two disembodied authorities, you know.
But I think that you really, it is something that if, you have to consider. I mean, I had Liz Hand come into my current school and talk to my class on the Gothic tradition. And again, they were very, taken with her status as a writer, a creator of this stuff. So yeah, I think students are prone to bow to the authority of the writer. And depending on what your own perspectives are, that's a good thing or a bad thing. But it's a thing, and it's something that you certainly have to take into consideration. I don't hesitate. I wouldn't hesitate to. Is you know, another arrow in the quiver in terms of my own.
Jim.
So I know this is extremely bad form, and considered an academia, but you all are your own resources. Why don't you teach yourselves?
It lacks class.
Well, I actually.
It's like big, I'm up in your pants.
Writing back to your own Amazon.
No, I'm going to tell a story that's directly related to this. I, for a long time, when the class was combined, and I had a combined fantasy and science fiction class, the last couple of works were always bugaboos for me because I had a hard time sort of wrapping things up. I didn't, you know, and therefore, you know, thus Sprock, you know, I was like, what do I? And so I tried different things there. One of the works I tried was something by a person named Jim Kelly called Burn. And I tried that there. That worked reasonably well also. And I tried Stanislaw Lem. I tried a whole bunch of different ones. And then my chairman said to me, why don't you teach your own novel? And my reaction was, oh, no, that's going to be weird. I don't know. I feel strangely dirty about doing that. I don't know. And I had people tell me, well, people teach their own textbooks. I said, yeah, but it's different. It's my. And he persisted. And he said, you know, you don't realize that doing that is going to give them again, that bridge. This is before I was able to bring in authors that I knew to speak to my class. And I said, okay, with great trepidation. It was a huge success. And so I've done that ever since. He was right, because what it did was it allowed me to speak to them directly with some time to do it about the process commercially and aesthetically that I had gone through and how I had learned, hopefully, from some of the other people that I had been teaching the rest of the semester. You know, I was very anxious to say, I'm not putting myself at the level of, you know, these you know, huge leading lights, but I did, Jim, exactly that, and it was a big success, actually. So, even though I still feel odd about it, but yeah.
I wouldn't do it because I hated the teachers who did that when I was a student. Perhaps formed by one high school teacher who would have us teach the one story he had published in The New Yorker, which was about a teenage boy and a marching band who comes to New York City and makes out with a girl, and it's all about his penis, and you don't want to hear about that from your high school teacher. And he was inappropriate with the girls anyway, but it is something that I actually...
Sounds like a rather...
What I associate it with. But actually, I think what Michael said about dropping his pants is actually relevant, because it would be so revealing. Right, I can read my texts, and they can read their my texts, and I can analyze my own texts and know what I was doing and why I'm doing that with feeding into that. But I don't need them to look into my psyche like that.
I'm teaching using the Wesleyan anthology in the fall in my science fiction class, which is a great anthology. It's got one of my stories in it. I'm not going to put it. Make them read it, but it's there.
It's there.
It works great. In the Gothic class, I put one of my stories in some reserve readings at the end and said, I'm not assigning this, you don't have to read it, but it's there if you want to. And just because I think it helped, I think in some ways, maybe if not drop your pants completely, at least loosen your belt. And, sort of let them know, well,
really
this
troubling
is what
metaphor.
I'm doing here within this tradition, take it or leave it, and I'm taking my chances with them. But I would be very uncomfortable forcing or requiring my students to read a work of fiction.
I think it would be interesting to write something specifically for a class, write something intended for that. You know, because it depends on the kind of stuff you conventionally write, and if your stuff is very personal or revelatory, you know, so I don't necessarily even want my colleagues reading that, let alone my students, just because it's. I don't know. I don't know how to deal with that, and that's perhaps a shortcoming on my part, and I'm perfectly willing to own that. But if I were to write something deliberately for a class, I mean, that might be able to work. So I don't know. That would be something I would think of.
Yes.
Sure.
I'm a musician rather than a writer, so if I'm going to teach somebody, it's going to be music. And just to chime in, I see no problem with starting off a student with one of my own songs that they admire from hearing my band. I mean, I think it's a matter of accessibility. And a matter of earning that respect all at the same time. So I have no problem with that. My question was on something Michael touched on, along with the area of accessibility. When you said you were teaching Hill House, mm-hmm. and somebody had a problem with an old mate being 30 years old, how much of a problem is that as far as, you know, making these works being accessible to the students these days? In other words, when they're so unfamiliar, with a lot of our past culture.
Yeah. It's a huge problem in my experience.
You have to try to create the cultural context, and that's a lot of work.
It would seem to me by the time you finish creating the cultural context,
you're out of time.
You sort of got to do it as you go, right? Like my graduate students, when I taught Nesbitt's five children, it said, well, obviously the reason they're getting into all this trouble is because no one's taking care of them all day because their father is in wherever and their mother is over here. And, you know, Martha, the servant, just sends them out to play. That's why it ends up story about how these poor neglected children, mm-hmm. and I know that's what you did with children. They're not neglected. That's just kids go we're far more independent.
But the side benefit of that is that teaching them, since we're teaching them not just what to think, but processes of thinking, if you construct that context for them, it will teach them to apply that context to other things. And isn't that something we desperately need people doing more of generally, applying context to things, right? Their historical and otherwise.
Try to learn the context.
Right, which applies across.
One of the questions that I ask when I'm working, I work predominantly with junior high and high school kids in a mixed group. And one of the things I do when I'm giving them reading is say, what do you need to know to understand this more fully?
Mm-hmm.
What are you missing for background? What questions do you need to ask in order to get what's going on here?
Mm-hmm.
We are unfortunately past our time. Thank you all.
Thank you, everybody.